If you're looking to move out of your parents' place, you could really cut expenses by bundling your car and renter's insurance with Progressive, which is good because your little brother has gotten really territorial. You're blood related. You'd think it would be fine to share food in the fridge. I mean, who writes their name on every individually wrapped slice of cheese, Tyler? Still, you've got to admire the commitment. So bundle your renter's and car insurance with Progressive and use the savings to help you move out and have all the cheese you want. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. Coverage provided in service by affiliates and third-party insurers.
Well, we'll talk, but can you cut this out?
Go. You got it on your own. So I'll hit you with that once we get rolling here. Pleased to have with us today on Whatever Nevermind, Chris Sinzak of the Decibel Geek podcast, a show largely started and primarily influenced by Cobras on Fire, if I understand it right.
That's a good one.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mitch.
Hey. At least you didn't squeeze in the last name. We're still covered then. Before we get into it, of course, Decibel Geek is home to yourself and Aaron Camaro, and you at one point used to get some regular contributions to your website from myself and Loose Cannon. How are things at Decibel Geek? Are we going to see an upcoming show where you guys are actually in the same room together?
That's a good question. I don't know. When the lockdown started, Aaron's got his in-laws living there, and I'm probably sharing some inside baseball I shouldn't, but his in-laws live in a different part of the house, and it's one of those things where it's like everybody's trying to be safe. So we haven't recorded together since I think March, and I'm just sort of waiting for the word to come down that yeah, come over and do it. I don't really mind doing it remotely because I get to drink more while I record, so that's more fun. I don't know if we're going to be in the same room again anytime soon, but we are getting into we're looking into doing some live streaming, and our good friend Rock and Ron Runyon is going to help come on board with that. And
that sounds like a train wreck, man.
Well, we figured Rock and Ron would be the moderator of the questions and everything, so it could be nothing but entertaining. So
fair enough.
So yeah, so we'll be looking into doing some live stuff for Decibel Geek soon on the net.
Well, what about maybe have you looked at maybe buying some audio recording equipment on your end and doing kind of a mashup thing that Luce and I do?
What do you mean?
Like we send our audio track. We each independently record ourselves. I actually had Aaron do it when he was on for Mad Season. So I get his audio. It's just a nicer sounding, more pleasant for the listener,
You mean this doesn't sound amazing right now?
Well, you always sound amazing, but I'm just thinking, take it to that extra notch of amazing Chris Sinzak. So
that sounds like work, but maybe we'll
think
about
okay. It. It does take it is a little extra effort, and I probably should say something mean to you before Craig Smith gets upset that I was too much of a gush fest for you.
You should give Toomey more shit because it was recently revealed that Toomey hadn't listened to enough Cobras and Fire to pick up that you guys took Rob Halford's vocal where he goes, Toomey.
Oh, my God.
Never heard that. That really bummed me out.
Oh, that son of a bitch. He didn't have the balls to tell me that.
Because every time you've played that on the show, I've laughed my ass off.
Oh, well, at least somebody enjoyed it. Yeah. I thought it might have been Toomey. So I'll be inserting it right there when you said it, and never again. Fuck you, Toomey. We are no longer friends.
At least I listen to the show, Toomey.
He's too busy recording 19 podcasts a week.
Yeah, no shit.
Whatever he's doing. Let's get a little bit into what we're talking about today. Coming in at number 14 on the Rolling Stones' greatest grunge albums of all time is Alice in Chains' Facelift. It was released on August 21st, 1990. Did you know it was not certified gold until September 11th, 1991, almost a little over a year later?
I did not know.
So it was clearly a slow grower. That's how I remember it. I actually saw them on the Clash of the Titans tour probably a month or two before I even bought this record. I didn't grasp onto, we'll get into it more as we get into it, but the Man in the Box didn't connect with me as quick as, for whatever reason, I just didn't grasp to it, because when I did, this whole album became pretty much a staple for me. Produced by Dave Jordan, 12 songs coming in at 54 minutes and 2 seconds. Well, let me back up a little bit here. Where do you come in with Alice in Chains? You requested this record outright, so I'm guessing you had this pretty soon after it came out.
Kind of. You know, going through and doing a little bit of research myself on this, I didn't realize that We Die Young, from like basically a demo version, was initially released to rock radio. Because I never heard it when it was out. Of course, I lived in Nashville where radio blows, so of course I didn't hear it. But I had the way I came into this was a friend of mine who was a friend of my brother's came into town, and he had the CD, I heard the CD first through him. But I remember it was like it must have been the same week that I saw the video for Man in the Box. And that was when I first – I mean the video was – couldn't have been more than 2 weeks old at the time. Nobody knew who the hell this band was. So and like maybe like you, I didn't really connect super big with Man in the Box. I thought it was interesting. But like he played the rest of the CD for me, and I kind of fell in love right away with the rest of the CD.
When they were getting ready to shoot the video for Man in the Box, Lane, this was kind of his song. So the director of it, and back in the days of faxes, asked him to like fax me like some ideas you have for the video. Mm-hmm. And this is the word for word what the fax said. Rainy, drippy barn, farm animals, baby with eyes sewn shut. So apparently the babies with eyes sewn shut was going to be a little too touchy, so they went with, I think, like basically an adult kind of Jesus kind of character.
Yeah, babies with eyes sewn shut is too touchy, but let's put Jesus with his eyes sewn shut. Exactly. That won't offend anybody.
So I guess I would say I probably had the record close to a year after it had been out. And I would think, man, there was a good chunk of time where this was a two-track record for me just because I liked those songs so much. The way this album opens, the 1-2 punch with We Die Young and Man in the Box, I was hitting the back button on my fucking CD player quite a bit during that, you know. Probably playing like Tecmo Bowl and, you know, just, you know, getting annoying the people that I'm playing with and all that stuff. Like, fucking put a whole CD in or something like that, but.
Yeah, Tecmo Bowl, where Bo Jackson would score every time, and he was white during the celebration.
Yeah, well, the original. All right, correct. Even on Tecmo Super Bowl, right? If you want to get nerdy, there was two versions.
Yeah,
the
it's
Super
just
Bowl,
got high five and it's white.
Yeah, I think most of the black guys were. Like it was the same graphic; they just switched the jerseys. But
right.
See, hot. Oh man, God, I want to play some Tecmo now. We should probably get into the record, though, here, Chris. I kind of gave it away. I kind of like the first two tracks. The album opens with We Die Young.
Forget hearing this riff for the first time, and I just was blown away by it because it was just it's such a beefy, like heavy fucking riff, and you know, and like, and I'll probably say this a few times through our conversation, Sean Kenny's drumming is like the kind of the unsung hero of this album.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody loves Lane's vocals, loves Jerry's guitar and the harmonies. Obviously, we'll get into that. But Sean Kenny's drumming is just fucking huge on this record. And I love this. I love the drum sound on this record. The drums are basically mixed kind of like a hair band album would have been mixed. Honestly, it's got really huge canyon sounding drums. And but yeah, the riff on this thing, it's like a sleazy detuned monster of a riff. And if this song doesn't grab you, then this album is not for you.
Good point.
No shit. That was the other thing that when I bought this, that like I was only familiar with Man in the Box. And there was this weird record store in Rochester, Minnesota. They would, to help prevent theft, they actually opened every CD, took the CD out, and kept it behind the counter, which is always kind of a bummer because it's like I'm buying a brand new CD, but they've already taken all the fresh, smelly stuff away from me, you know, the long boxes and all, whatever it was in. Man, I think I probably just played fucking track two to begin with and then started over. Just, you don't get fucking better than We Die Young. And you nailed it. That riff is like, I don't even know how the fuck you come up. Did you ever learn how to play this song?
Yes.
I mean, it's so fucking fun to play.
Oh, dude, we'll get into this. But yeah, this album had back when I was still a musician, this album was a massive influence on me.
Yes.
And I ripped off numerous riffs, vocal melodies, everything from it.
I think Alice in Chains and Soundgarden, because right around this time, I'm just turning 20, 21, and now I'm thinking about like being in a band and stuff like that and writing my own songs. You know, my background being all this kind of poppy hair metal kind of stuff, and then just kind of get into, but I've always liked the more serious topics that they talked about, you know, and that's probably why I got into punk music and bands like Pink Floyd, because it still kind of gave me music I liked, but talked about things that weren't so repetitious and stupid. And man, this record was a huge influence on me in that way. So was Dirt, but and as a guitar player too, this was kind of when I started learning about drop D tuning and all that kind of good stuff.
When you learn about drop D tuning as a guitar player, you realize, well, it's like you can do a whole lot more that you didn't think you could do. You can really kick out some great riffs. And. And also, like, you know, the whole theme, we die young, faster we run. Like, when you're a teenager hearing that, that's like a rallying cry. You know, it's, you know, of course, it's kind of sad when you think about it in hindsight. But it was this song just kills, man. I mean, I remember when I first learned the riff, I couldn't get enough of playing that song.
And I love when it kicks up into that kind of that higher basic power chord with that. Watch where you stand. This song fucking grooves. I'm ready to give my rating. What have you decided? What's our grunge rating system today? We're going to have one or going to have a bunch? What do you got for us?
So I guess we're going to base it on 0 to 5 Mike stars.
I like that. you don't get much more Seattle than that. Yeah. I give it 5 Mike stars.
It's a 5, definitely. Yeah. Well, it's a perfect album opener.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a perfect introduction to Alice in Chains, too, if you think about it. All right. Well, the next track most people have heard, probably too much, is Man in the Box. I don't crave this song too much anymore, but I got to tell you, when I listen to it, like if it's still on the radio, if I'm actually paying attention, I still kind of get fired up because it kind of builds to the solo. But then when Lane comes in out of that solo and just goes next level with that,
yeah.
that guy was good. Jesus Christ. Whatever. But this is brilliant. I mean, I'll spare people the drama. This is a 5 Mike star for me. What do you got?
Well, this one, you know, it's one of those that obviously all of us in the 90s got burned out on this song. Mm-hmm. You know, that was because it got played ridiculous amounts. It still gets played a lot on the rock radio, at least here.
Heard it
but
today.
Yeah, it's a great trend. Let me go ahead and say this. You know, I know Dave Jordan produced it. I don't know if Dave Jordan was the decision maker on the sequencing of this record, but this album is sequenced perfectly.
Hmm.
Like, because it has the fast, the slow, it's got highs and lows. It definitely the way. And back then, that was a real art, you know, because people would listen to full albums. Now it doesn't really matter much, but back then that actually made a difference how an album would flow from start to finish, because you would put a CD on and you wouldn't want to get up and change it. So the fact that it would go from kind of the adrenaline pumping pace of We Die Young into kind of a nice groove metal. Mm-hmm. Track with Man in the Box made it. It was a great second track. I like the song. I love the use of the talk box. Mm-hmm. I remember at the time, Do You Feel Like We Do by Peter Frampton was getting played a lot on classic rock radio. So I remember when I first heard it, I'm like, oh, they're doing the thing Frampton does. You know, I thought that was cool. And I will say this, Jerry Cantrell was
Show Me the Way too. Okay.
Yeah, maybe not so much, but Jerry Cantrell's guitar solo, like, and the way I viewed it, I was already a Kiss fan by the time I got into Alice in Chains, so the way I viewed him was kind of Ace Frehley with more soul, you know, because it's a lot, and a lot of that goes back to Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, and that type of stuff. But I know Ace Frehley was a direct influence on him. So you've got the talk box, but then Jerry Cantrell's solo was like, I mean, this was still the days of the shredding guitar player, which I love. I've got Becker Cacophony, I've got Paul Gilbert, I've got Racer X, I've got all those albums. But it was nice to have something where, you know, you take the foot off the gas and you actually kind of bend something and really, you know, let it ring out. And the solo on this song is great. I remember I'll never forget seeing the video. I'm like, wow, Jesus, his eyes are sewn shut. That's kind of fucked up. But
goats walking around.
Yeah. And they're like playing in a barn. It was like it was unlike any video I had ever seen. And honestly, this video was more jarring to me than Teen Spirit was by Nirvana. Like, I mean, Nirvana.
Oh, absolutely. Kinda, absolutely.
Yeah, so like Nirvana came in and that was different too, because they're playing like a high school gym and everything. But this video was like, what the fuck is going on here? It was very different than anything else going on. But yeah, I mean, overall, I love the song. I don't really go back to it much because it's ingrained in my DNA at this point. But it's a good groove rocking song.
Not as fun to play in guitar as a We Die Young.
It's kind of boring compared to that.
Yeah, and it's also because if you don't have one of those talk boxes, you never really pull it off.
Yeah, otherwise it's just basic riff. You know,
you've seen a cover band, I assume, play this song with.
Sure.
They'll use a wah or maybe one of those whammy pedals that became popular
played this song in a cover band with a wah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I have too. I was not the lead guitar player, so I just did the dent.
Yeah,
a little more fun to sing than it is to play, but yeah. Well, what's your rating? I don't keep us waiting.
I'll give it a 4.
Oh man, what do they got to do to get a 5 out of you?
Sweet Ida Young got a 5.
Good point.
Well, that brings us to track 3, Sea of Sorrow.
Caught off the chains.
Favorite track on the record.
Really?
Yes. And that's saying something because I love most of this album. I love the bluesy intro. It almost has a piano type sound.
Yeah, I think there is actually a piano.
Is it a piano?
Going back to prep for this, I always was just picturing it more like a plucked guitar part, right?
Mm-hmm.
My entire life. It sounds like there is just a little bit of piano right away,
yeah.
And then the guitar comes. It might even be at the same time on top of each other, and then it builds up a little bit, but yeah.
Well, that's the genius of Dave Jordan who produced it. You know, while we're on Dave Jordan, let me just mention, I read that, because I did a little bit of research for this, and Dave Jordan, he had a great quote. He said that when they were, like, courting Dave Jordan to be the producer, he said, "Well, Metallica sped up Tony Iommi's riffs, and you slowed it down." And Jerry Cantrell was like, "You get it. That's why you're getting the job." No, but that kind of all encompasses, because there is a Sabbath influence in a lot of this stuff.
Well, in that book that I mentioned, this is called I thought I had it here. It's just like the Untold Story of Alice in Chains or something like that by David DeSola. Sorry, I'm scrapping the title, but they talk about that. And David Jordan takes a little bit of credit for slowing them down even a bit. I don't think he's not claiming that they were playing like Man in the Box at Slayer speed, but he was saying like even a beat or two a minute to him made a lot of difference in kind of creating that Alice in Chains kind of sound. So it is a brilliant sounding record.
Yeah.
And before I forget, you mentioned Sean Kinney's a drummer. Did you know he broke his wrist in a fight before this record started? They tried to use a fill-in drummer, and he ended up just taking the bandages off and playing through it.
Yeah, they said the guy from Temple of the Dog was going to play
the
record.
There we go.
And it just wasn't happening. And like the record company got excited because they were like, "We got to get this out," because they were really getting hyped on it. And Sean Kinney was like, "Well, fuck it, just put a bucket of ice next to me," and he would ice his hands down in between in between takes, which is crazy. Imagine playing drums with a broken hand. That's crazy.
Yeah.
This is my favorite song on the record, just because this song has so many facets to it. You know, it starts out real bluesy sounding, and then Sean Kinney does that little tom build up, and then it launches into basically straight up hard rock, where, you know, it's like I can't remember the lyrics right now,
the pre-chorus is incredible with that "You open fire."
Yeah, that's almost AC/DC-ish, you know? And it's even got the cannon sound going off in the song.
Yeah.
You know, it's like grunge bands later would never even attempt something like that. So it was like it was kind of undiscovered territory where it's like we can play around and do whatever we want. But I love that. And it's Jerry Cantrell's best solo on the record. I know he thinks Love, Hate, Love is his favorite solo on the record, but his solo on Sea of Sorrow is fucking perfect. It's just – it's incredible. The song – and also at the end, you get the part where Mike Starr starts doing that pulsating bass line.
Yeah.
That adds a lot to it. And then as it's fading out, then you get Jerry Cantrell going in with like kind of a thrashy riff part where he's chunking along with it. Little things like that make a difference to me. So it's one of those things where it's like they build and build and build, and it's building as it fades out, and you almost want more.
Yeah.
But it's a great way to end the song.
And I think Mike Starr's contributions to this band were missed. I don't have a big problem with Michael Inez, but I just think that something changed with the sound a little bit. And in the book they talk that it sounds like I get the impression Jerry never got along with Mike, and Mike was a bit of Like he put on a false front. Like, you know, he was probably one of the better looking guys in the band, so he did better with the ladies, and that probably pissed off Jerry, especially when he had no respect for as a musician. There was a song, it got left off of Dirt. We won't need to get into that. I'll save it for the Dirt episode. But like, he had a guy come in. Basically, Dave Jordan contacted the person. I can't remember who it was. It wasn't the guy from Mother Love Bone, but he had bought all of his bass gear from. And the guy comes in, he dials it in, and Jordan's like, there it is. That's the song we're looking for. And apparently Mike had a tendency to just fuck with the knobs a lot. I'm sure you play with musicians like that.
Yep.
That between every song, they were, for some reason, even though they're just changing their overall tone, they duct taped it, put duct tape across the front so that, like, while they recorded this record, just leave that. That's the perfect sound. But, there's some times where it seems like he was, like, you know, just really kind of sheepish and didn't feel confident on both the records that he recorded with them, this and Dirt. But it's too bad how things ended with him as well. But this song, for me, I agree with everything you said. All the one thing different is, so far out of these three songs, this is my third favorite. But
really?
It still gets 5 Mike stars from me. We're 5 all the way. What do you got?
Oh, well, if I could give it 10, I would. But yeah, 5.
Well, if you had been listening, you can rate it whatever the hell you want. So you
I'll give it 10 then.
All right, so this is 10 Mike stars for you. All right. Up next is Bleed the Freak.
This is probably my second favorite song on the record. I love this one. This is, you know, and I don't know if other people hear this the way I do, but like the kind of the droning opening riff kind of has a Hell's Bells type vibe to it. You know, it's a little bit of AC/DC type vibe to it. Just kind of moody sounding.
Yeah, okay.
And then the whole line, my cup runneth over like blood from a stone. I don't know what that means, but it sounds cool. Which is a lot of Layne Staley's lyrics. I don't really understand what exactly they mean, but I like them.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not a lyrics guy, but for some reason with his lyrics, I would always pay attention. I love this song. I love the way it kind of comes in with the chorus early on, and the main verse riff is really heavy. You know, I like that. Jerry's solo's great on it. And then of course it's got the little slow part in the middle of, you know, where it kind of goes halftime.
Yeah, that's cool.
The whole bleed for me part, and then it builds back up to the chorus. That's kind of a hard rock trick that they put in there that you wouldn't normally hear with grunge songs. So this song is another one of those where it's kind of a bridge between hard rock and grunge.
I think they benefited by not breaking right away. Like, because they were just in that time when Slaughter was just coming hot. You know, if they would have had, like, or even, like, wasn't Cherry Pie a 1990 record?
I think so.
Yeah, so, like, this is that time, you know, where that's still kind of the main thing. And the fact that they kind of broke after that was kind of starting to dwindle down helped them. Because I think they might have been kind of dismissed a little bit if they would have had, like, you know, instant success with the record. Right. And then once, you know, Nirvana kind of, you know, released their stuff, I don't know they would have been brought along. They would have probably been treated more like Queensryche than fucking, you know, Soundgarden. So,
yeah. Well, it's an interesting band because, I don't know, like, Nirvana gets all the love, and obviously Pearl Jam still does to this day. But, I mean, like, it's, you know, kind of in the hierarchy of the grunge, of the big four of grunge, it always seems to be Nirvana, Pearl Jam, then Soundgarden, then Alice in Chains. I would reverse it. To me, it's Alice in Chains first, then Soundgarden, then Pearl Jam, and then Nirvana.
Good point.
Yeah, actually, I would rank them the same way, too. If I was going personal preference, those... I mean, it's really close with Alice in Chains and Soundgarden. Clearly, Pearl Jam would be my third one. I've just never clicked with Nirvana. And there is an opportunity to talk a little bit on that coming up, too. This is now the, I would put this ahead of CSRO as far as my personal taste, but this is another five for me.
Yeah, it's definitely a five for me.
Up next, track five, we have I Can't Remember.
Turn around and say, excuse the tooth, but I haven't eaten today. My eyes are turning gray.
What's your name?
I can't remember.
This one, the very opening kind of chords to this, it almost reminds me of like 80s Black Sabbath. Mm. If you're thinking like Eternal Idol kind of era stuff.
Huh.
But where does this album, where does this song come in for you?
I like it. It's one of those that I didn't so much connect with when it was out, when it was new. I like it more as I've gotten older. But it's got such a nice ambient acoustic thing going on at the beginning of the song. It's different. Me and the singer from my band, we ripped off the main melody from this song where I can't remember identity, and it's got that build on the lyrical part. We ripped that off for one of our songs. Not that we did it any better, believe me. I like the melody line in this song, and I like the acoustic part. It does kind of drag a bit. It's definitely not my favorite song on the record, but I do like it. I never skip this song. It's always good, and I love the bass tone on this song is real fucking heavy. You know, when Mike Starr comes in with that low note, it hits you in the guts. I do love this song overall.
Not me so much. This there's two tracks that get my lowest rating on here, and this is one of them. I think it's real forgettable. I don't look forward to hearing it. It does still resonate in that, like, it seems like it needs to be there, but I would have been okay with the two songs I gave threes just being removed from this and being a 10-track record. That said, I think I just said it. Three stars for me.
I'd give it four. Yeah, it's almost there. But it's a good track overall for me. There are a couple of songs on here that I don't like.
The next one would be another one for me, Love Hate Love, which I know Jerry, you mentioned that he likes the solo. Jerry loves Love Hate Love.
I tried to love you. I thought I could. I tried to own you. I thought I would.
Year-old me liked it a lot more than the 43-year-old me likes it now. When I was young, I really liked it a lot. I guess the 17-year-old me, because I was still in high school when I got this record. But definitely at the time it was a mind blower of a song, because you certainly didn't hear anything like this anywhere else,
right?
And it builds, and this is another one. We ripped off, we copped the melody line, especially the way it builds. You told me I was the only one. You know, that we ripped that off for one of our, that was our set closer in my horrible band that Josh Toomey still makes fun of to this day.
And what band was that?
It was called Primrose Way.
And what was the song that you ripped off? What did you call your version of this?
It was called Black Eyes. It was a song that me and the singer for the band, we co-wrote, and it was about his girlfriend at the time in high school that was insane, and she got put away in an institution, and that's what the song was about.
In fucking high school?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, she got committed when she was like 16.
She sounds fucked up.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun at parties. And then the name
crazy
of the band,
bitch.
Yeah, she's pretty crazy. And the name of the band came from, do you remember Dante's Inferno, the book?
Yeah.
So that was where the name came. It was like, it's this Primrose Way is like the pleasant tourist guide through hell.
Was that on the Third Ring of Hell? That's a Jesus Chrysler tune.
I couldn't remember. The singer came up with the name. I just thought it was cool.
Yeah, but, actually, I don't know why. Toomey hates the name?
No, he just makes fun of it. Because somehow I mentioned it on the show that I was in a band called Primrose Way.
And okay.
Anytime I mention anything, he's like, oh, Primrose Way needs to reunite. And I'm like, no, nobody needs to hear that.
He's but, like that.
But yeah, we totally ripped off Love, Hate, Love to do one of our songs. And
why didn't you rip off one of the good songs?
Oh, I like the song. It's not that bad.
Love, hate, love. Not a lot of work on the melody for that chorus, but
no. I mean, if it was a minute and a half shorter, I think you would like it more. They dragged on for way too long. But I like the melody overall. But at this point in time, as a 43-year-old guy, I'll say it's a 3 Mike stars.
Ooh, your lowest rating so far. Yeah, this never grabbed me at all. The title even seems – I don't like the title, Love, Hate, Love. It just seems like – it seems like they had this music built, and that's why it's so long, and it's almost got that kind of epic kind of thing. And it's like Lane writes some lyrics, and this is the best he could come up with. So, but, yeah, Jerry talks about this quite a bit. I'm almost surprised it's not in their set list as much as I've heard him reference it. But
yeah, but I can't see William Duvall singing this song.
Well, yeah, I guess. Man, I don't know. Just not a lot for me. But again, three Mike stars, so we're on the same rating there. But
okay.
We're just at the end of side one then, Chris. Before we get into side two, let's talk a little bit about the tour that they went on. Now, their first after the record was released, their first slot was opening for Extreme, which apparently was kind of an odd pairing. Well, it is an odd pairing, but if you go back in time, the almost the way they've kind of tried to set tours up with similar sounding bands has gotten more and more, you know, controlled. Where, you know, the further back you go, you might see Joe Walsh tour with, like, you know, a Black Sabbath or something like that. But it is weird. And one of the things they talked about is that, like, Extreme kind of came from that old school thinking of, like, you don't get no stage, you don't get no lights, you don't get no PA, that kind of bullshit that I've never really understood too much. I understand that you can't bring your own full on light show and pyro and crap like that, but why can't they use a decent amount of, and in PA especially, why are you trying to make them not sound? You know, I mean, it doesn't really affect when you're in the audience. I've never been in a show where I was like, oh, thank God the headliner sounded louder than the opener. You know what I mean? It doesn't appeal to me. It just seems kind of shitty. But that's kind of an old school thing. But by the end, the last day of the tour, they decided that they could do whatever the hell they want because they're like, what are you going to do, kick us off? And apparently, like, Mike Starr vomited on the he got too drunk and vomited on the drums. And they were like just drinking and smoking and spilling shit everywhere on the stage. So clearly not fans of the Extreme guys. They also thought they were really corny and cheesy. I like Extreme. I would have actually enjoyed to see this band with Extreme. It would have been an odd pairing, but I could give a crap. How about you?
Well, I mean, personally, I like a lot of Extreme stuff too. But if I'm in the mindset of Lane Staley, circa 1990, probably don't want to hear them doing Kid Ego and shit like that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, I can see how it doesn't work. And then they also fucking opened for Poison. Can you imagine Alice in Chains and Poison concert?
That would have been a difficult one for me. I would have not dropped the ducats for that. You're a Poison guy. Did you go?
No, I did not. I didn't get to see Poison until 1998.
This would have been pre Richie Kotzen Poison though, still, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It was the Flesh and Blood tour when CeCe was still in the band.
Yeah.
but it's like Unskinny Bop and Man in the Box. What a weird combination.
Oh man. Well, I don't think these guys were actually worrying. I mean, how does that even come about? I'm trying to think. because Poison probably Alice in Chains isn't on Bret Michaels' radar at this point. You know what I mean?
Well, wait, what label was Alice in Chains on? Was
they were
it
on Columbia?
Columbia,
yeah.
And if I remember right, so was Poison. So there's your answer.
No, they were Capitol.
Was it Capitol? Okay. Well, then I don't know how those two get put together. Like, unless the guys in Poison were like, this is the future. We need to latch on to it.
No. Bret Michaels, especially, who is a driving creative force in that band, he latches on to trends 5 to 6 years after they're clearly popular.
Yeah, just like Kiss does.
Yeah, no shit. Well, in fairness, Kiss has never done a cover of Sublime's What I Got.
When you consider what time this album came out, promoters didn't know what to do with this band.
Yeah, they probably just seemed like a heavier version of hair metal.
Yeah, so they were probably just like, just throw them on there with Poison, throw them on there with Extreme. You know, they fit better on the Clash of the Titans tour, even though they're not a thrash band.
Yeah, and that was kind of a weird billing. That one stuck out to me more, because when I went to that they were there, but it sound wise, it fit right in. They were great. They came out and killed it. Like I said, the crowd wasn't super into them, but they weren't fucking throwing shit, and they weren't getting booed or pissed on. You know, they were a decent amount of applause, and then the crowd got a little bigger once the day went on. That was a really fucking weird show, though, Chris. It started at like 1 p.m, and it was an hour and a half drive from where I lived, and the sun was just setting when I got home, so it was over at like 7 o'clock at night.
Wow!
And it's an outdoor festival at this place called Trout Air. It's now a horse racing track, but back then it was I remember MTV, there was like some alternative band festival going on there, and they were there live years later, and like some of the bands were there fishing because there's like a stock trout pond that you could rent fishing poles and a boat and go out there, so it was all part of this whole thing. But yeah, it was just weird that you're out here. And I remember Megadeth got the headlining slot because it was Minnesota and Dave Ellison's our boy.
Yeah,
so
hometown guy. Yeah.
And I remember Dave Mustaine complaining like, yeah, I'm sick as hell. I was going to cancel, but it's Junior's homecoming. So, and it's like, in fairness, Junior lives about 6 hours away from here, Dave. But
that's never a good move. Like, you really think you're going to win the crowd over going saying something? That's like, I went and saw Hall and Oates last year, and John Oates, Daryl Hall goes, hello, Nashville. I hadn't played here in a while. And John Oates gets on the mic and goes, yeah, I live here now. And Daryl Hall gets up back on the mic and goes, yeah, that's why we're doing this show.
Oh, Jesus.
And then he got booed for the rest of the night.
That's too bad. I'm sure he meant well.
He's a fucking asshole.
Daryl Hall?
Yes.
God, he got salty about
that whole. That whole show was a clusterfuck, dude. Those guys were actually fighting on stage. It was crazy.
Nice. I like the fact they don't like each other. Fuck John Oates. Who the fuck he think he is? Daryl Hall?
He seems like a cooler guy than Daryl Hall, though.
Yeah, he's just shorter. That's all.
He's got the mustache, though. Give him that.
They did. They jumped on with Iggy Pop for a while, which is always weird to me because I think of Iggy Pop as like this thing. This existing
thing.
I don't recall him as a musician or like a productive guy. I know he's got his history with the Stooges and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But in 1990, I'm like, you're just this guy that MTV props out for jokey bits and stuff.
Yeah. He was a novelty.
So it's weird that he was actually on tour. And apparently at a Thanksgiving stop, wherever they were at, they met up with Prong and Pantera at it. They're all in the same hotel. And like basically like they were just waiting for the bar to open so they could go watch football and get hammered all day. There's a pretty good story in that book about that. But that would have been kind of fun.
Iggy Pop and Alice in Chains. That's a strange combination.
Well, apparently Iggy was nicer to him than Extreme. He let him use pretty much all the lights in the PA. But
he seems like a good guy.
Yeah. One of the funner facts I came across is that this what helped break Man in the Box is that MTV decided to make it part of it at the time coveted Buzzbin. Do you remember the Buzzbin videos?
I do.
It was supposed to be kind of an up-and-coming, hot new thing, and then it would get like a regular rotation. Do you know who? It was down to two bands. I'm guessing you don't know who the other one is, but it was between them and Blue Murder with Jelly Roll.
I love that song.
I do too, but what a weird, I'm like, I don't understand the decision here. This aging, these two aging guys who are both just members of everybody's band on a project that's clearly not going to last. Right. It was cool as it is. I like that first Blue Murder record, and I love that song, Jelly Roll, but you know, it's just funny the idea that MTV execs were sitting there going, what do you think, Blue Murder or Alice in Chains? It's kind of odd.
I'm amazed that Blue Murder made the buzz bin. I never knew that.
Well, they didn't. Alice in Chains took it. It was that was their last chance. They'd still be together, Chris, if they got the buzz bin slot. Yeah, of course not.
Yeah,
John Sykes. He quits a band before they make it to the recording studio, for Christ's sake.
That's true. Yeah, he's Vinnie Vincent level genius.
Oh man, probably a better guy. And then
I've heard stories.
I've heard a lot of talk from they did a Van Halen tour. I think this was this Balance at the time. No, it was before that. For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge.
Yeah, it was the fuck record.
Yeah, okay. So they toured with Van Halen during that, and I know Eddie and Jerry got they developed a friendship at the time, and Jerry told the story that after the tour he got home and his garage was filled with a bunch of Eddie Van Halen amps and guitars. So Eddie would whip out a couple of Alice in Chains riffs if he saw Jerry standing on the side of the stage or something like that. But yeah, this is also notable because apparently on this tour is when Layne Staley's girlfriend Demree introduces him to heroin, which of course we all know that how that goes. But too bad for that. But any other Alice in Chains touring memories you want to share before I get into some of these standard stock questions I have prepared for you?
Well, I never got to see them on tour.
Recently, or?
Well, I mean, I'll explain that. Okay. I mean, like, I was going to see them in 93 or 4. They were supposed to open for Metallica on the Binge and Purge tour. Okay. It was going to be Metallica, Alice in Chains, and Suicidal Tendencies. And right as the tour is about to begin, Layne OD'd, and he had to go to rehab. And I loved Metallica, obviously, but... And I had already seen – I saw Metallica on And Justice for All, but I wasn't that hyped to see Metallica that time. I was going to see Alice in Chains. I had bought tickets and everything. And when they dropped off, they're like, okay, Candlebox is going to fill in. I was like, oh, fuck.
Alice in Chains light.
Yeah. And I couldn't even give the tickets away. I tried giving and then a bunch of my friends were going like, well, you should still go. We should go and hang out. So like, all right, I'll go to hang out with you guys. And this really pissed me off during the show is like midway through the fucking concert, the assholes in Metallica get up and start playing Man in the Box and they start smacking their fucking arm, like making fun of a heroin abuser and like making fun of Layne Staley. And I get it. They're probably pissed because it's like they probably would have made more money if Alice in Chains was on that tour, I'm sure. But these fuckers, it's just like, you know, and like I didn't shed a tear for James when he went into rehab a few years later. It's like, you know what? Fuck you, dude. You know, that just to this day, it makes me mad to even think about it. But
that's pretty cheap.
Yeah, it was just bullshit. It's
and
like
if they did it where you were at. They probably did it a few other shows, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they did it everywhere. But it was just like, you know, and plus you assholes are drinking a fucking case of beer each, you know, before your show. Let's make fun of addiction.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was that whole show left a bad taste in my mouth. I didn't see Metallica again until 2 years ago on Death Magnetic or whatever. And so I missed them that time. And then, as you probably remember, like the Kiss reunion tour got announced and it was going to be STP. And then they dropped off because of Scott's problems. And then Alice in Chains was the first band. Beginning of the tour, and I almost went to Louisville because it was the first show after Detroit because I wanted to see both bands because I was a huge Alice in Chains fan at this time. And then But I was like, oh, they'll hit Nashville eventually, and I'll see Alice in Chains then. Well, of course, as you know, the band fell apart.
Now, my recollection was that there was never going to be a long-term opener. Like I remember from the beginning, and I could be wrong because we're talking such a long time ago. Yeah. In my head, it was never going to be Alice in Chains for the whole tour, even though...
Well, I may have assumed that incorrectly.
Yeah, all right. Fair enough. There was also, this is not when the internet's available everywhere, or at least we're to the point where, like, you just want to know something, you hit it right away. But I don't know how I would have known that, but which is why I have to question it a little bit, but, you know, maybe it's just convenient, you know, recollection.
And then every time after that, you know, of course, you know, Lane, the band broke up after that. Like, Unplugged was great and all, but even watching Unplugged, you knew the band was done for just because Lane was just not in good shape.
Yeah, he didn't look good.
No.
Sounded good.
He sounded great. And, like, and I, you know, I'm friends with Toby Wright, and Toby says to this day that's one of his favorite things. That's the best performance they ever did. But you know, they came back with William Duvall, and I've liked certain tracks, but I just cannot bring myself to buy a ticket to watch them without Lane Staley. It's not the same to me. And maybe I'm being an elitist or whatever, but it just, if I'm going to pay a money for a ticket to see Alice in Chains, Lane Staley needs to be the guy up there.
They're pretty much the band you want to see at a festival, not at like your local venue and on a tour stop. That's how.
So you've seen them with William.
Yeah, but only in that setting. I'm with you. If they did, I don't recall them touring through here on any of the records they've done. But I would not have gone. I saw Jerry solo, but.
Yeah, and I'm sure William does a great job, and like everything I've heard, and I even like the records, but overall, but it's just it will never fully connect with me without Lane.
Sure, no, he was too big of a part, and I understand that what they're doing and why they're carrying on, but sure. Yeah, I would say with three records that they've done, they have one really good record out of those three. There's standout tracks that I really get into, but there hasn't been one. They sound a lot kind of like Jerry's solo career, where just didn't kind of flesh out. I'll go back to Degradation Trip on this little experience here. I did not expect to gravitate to that record now like I did. It is so much better than I gave it credit for at the time.
Well, I love that one, and I love Boggy Depot. I think they're both really good. But
I didn't care for Boggy Depot other than a few tunes, but maybe I need to go back and check that out now. So,
but I will say the... you know, the title track from Black Gives Way to Blue, that about brought me to tears.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
about,
pretty heavy, man.
It's about Lane, and that's one of the most heartfelt things I've ever heard.
Yeah, it really is. Now, he credits it to being about Lane and Mike now, but I'm convinced based on reading that book that it's more about his relationship with Lane. Not to take a cheap shot at Mike, but I don't think he was ever close with him.
But yeah, I was going to say, you're right. I've never had the feeling that Jerry and Mike were like best buddies or anything.
I think he just didn't like him that much. I mean, we've all been in bands, you know. It's great for the first 10 practices, but you know, things start to flesh out and you start to realize people aren't that compatible. And
do you have something you want to get about Treble off your chest?
Yeah,
right,
Treble's a fucking asshole. He's clearly not the one I'm talking about.
I know. I'm just talking with you.
No, he's a good dude. I wish I would have started a band with him 10 years before I did. or started the band with him, I should say. He came in about 10 years in, but...
I will tell you, I was going to wear my Jesus Chrysler t-shirt today, but it's actually in the dirty laundry right now.
All right, fair enough. It's all good. Well, let me ask you this. When grunge first happened, what were you listening to leading up to? Let's just use Nevermind as the time place. So leading up to that, what was the regular kind of things you were spinning?
Well, see, to me, I thought it was a great time in music because I was – so like 1990, I was 13 going on 14. So – to me, it was an amazing time of discovery for stuff. So I was still listening to Dokken, Motley Crue, Kiss. Obviously, tons of Kiss because like Hot in the Shade was the first album I bought on release day. But at the same time, I had gotten into thrash metal. I'd gotten into Metallica, Megadeth, all that stuff. I was in the Pantera pretty early on. Cowboys from Hell came out, and a friend of mine let me hear By Demons Be Driven.
That's right. That was 1990.
Yeah, and I got really into Pantera, so I was into that. So I was into all that stuff, and then grunge came in at the same time, and Smells Like Teen Spirit never hit me like it should have. Everybody that I knew loved it, and I was like, it's okay. And it's funny. It's one of those things I remember at the time. I was taking guitar lessons about a year before, and my guitar teacher had, you know, given me the first Boston record, and he was like, mm-hmm. "This is all you like. This is rock and roll personified. You need to learn how to play this stuff."
Boston, you're talking about?
Yeah, Boston, the first Boston record from '76, and the first time I heard Teen Spirit, and it's funny, it was confirmed later on in an interview with Kurt Cobain that he ripped off More Than a Feeling. And I remember the first time I heard it, I'm like, it sounds like More Than a Feeling, like out of tune. But yeah, so like, you know, you've got kind of a great convergence of glam metal, thrash metal, grunge. And then you've also got other, you know, kind of oddity bands like the Chili Peppers and stuff like that hitting at the same time. I love the variety of it all. So to me, I had a good time listening to everything at the time. So I didn't really – it was weird because, like, I started playing in bands not too long after this. And we would be playing covers of Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains songs. But I had a fucking, like, tiger stripe guitar strap because I love George Lynch.
I had a pink Ironbird with black tiger stripes on it during this time. So
yeah. So, like, an Ironbird, that's a great guitar. And but, like, I would get shit for that all the time. They're like, oh, you fucking hair metal guitar strap. What the fuck? Get it just a regular color. I'm like, fuck you. I want to play, you know, Motley Crue rules, and so does Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
But like we would cover Porch by Pearl Jam and Garden and stuff like that. And but yeah, I was kind of the wacky person in my group that wouldn't kind of I wouldn't stray from what I liked. I would like different things. And like, you know, they'd be like, oh, well, if you like the new Pearl, because the first Pearl Jam record, have you done that on the show yet?
Not yet. No, that's pretty high on the list.
I would volunteer myself for that if you don't have a person. But that first Pearl Jam record is incredible. I would love that. And we would cover songs off of it. And then I'd be like, oh, have you heard the new Dokken record? And they'd be like, fuck you. And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm like, why do we have to take so many sides on genres? It's like, you know, fuck all. You can like everything.
I think probably because I definitely understood at that time why it was like that. It was very much – I understood why it was funny to throw darts at Kip Winger in a Metallica video.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But I was older. You know what I mean? I think it would have been really difficult for me because if I had been your age, but like when I was your age, everything I liked, people hated anyway. You know, right. I mean, I Kiss was never popular in my little social group. There was, you know, I would go to my I had 40 classmates. One other one liked Kiss. We got made fun of all the fucking time. And so I never really had that thing, the big of a problem liking things other than wanting to hide it from the cool kids. But I got it. I mean, I regrettably so, because I bought in 100%. And I'm not going to carry on too much because I've covered that a lot on previous episodes. But to me, I almost switched gears. It was like, nope, I kept Kiss, I kept Thrash, and everything else. I'm going to the UCD store, man. I'm going to sell all my Motley Crue and Dokken and get the latest, you know, Pearl Jam release or whatever. You know, Guns N' Roses kind of carried through that too, but
right.
What about
like
after?
They were like the one rock and roll band that you could safely still
buy. Yeah, until Kurt Cobain made fun of them. But
that's true.
let me you kind of touched on it, but after grunge broke, were you kind of slowly into it, or were you like, yep, this is kick ass, and so is the new Dokken?
Yeah, that was me. I mean, I didn't view it really as different genres. You know, a lot of people did at the time, but. You know, although, like, my girlfriend at the time was really into Blind Melon. You remember Blind Melon?
Yeah.
And certain things like that. Like, some of the stuff that got real big on a massive scale, I would kind of shun because it just irritated me. But
I never got into Blind Melon, but I got to tell you, that guitar solo, that kind of acoustic thing on their big hit, No Rain, that is... There's some pop perfection as far as guitar playing.
It's fine, but I got just fucking sick of it. But
well, you know, that vocal on there, you know, everybody talks about Shannon Hoon. Well, not everybody. at the time, he got a lot of credit for kind of being this new kind of breed of whatever, right? That guy has got a saturated as fuck, you know, vocal with some kind of modulation on there. I don't know if it's just a chorus or a flange or something, but it is one of the, it's the opposite of clean. They would use auto-tune or something like that to kind of, but I was like, I don't know that this guy was any good or not. And right now, every fucking, all eight of their fans are like, you haven't heard Soup. Thanks for that fucking tip.
I have a copy of that record to this day, but I like Soup, but I didn't care for the whatever the one No Rain was on. I didn't like. But Soup had that song Galaxy, which is a great song.
That is a much better song.
Yeah, God, I mean, fucking Blind Melon, anything that got like massive saturation level, and that's probably what turned me off to Nirvana. And you know, maybe I'm being a anti-poser or whatever, but like if it got massive, I would hate it. It just used to bug me because like I would listen to Alice in Chains, like, you know, we'd listen to Facelift and Dirt and stuff like that. And then other people would be playing, you know, Where Did You Sleep Last Night by Nirvana going, this is genius. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Well, now you've been doing your podcast almost 10 years now. I know you've been chomping at the bit to answer a question I guarantee you've answered on your own show. Did it kill hair metal?
The grunge itself did not kill hair metal. The industry killed hair metal. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I hate to admit this, but it's true. I mean, like, whatever the powers that be, i.e. MTV, Top 40 Radio, Spin Magazine, Rolling Stone Magazine, those powers that be decide what is going to be big. And I hate to say that, but it's true.
I get what you're saying, but the only thing that I disagree with in that is like people still have to buy it, so it can't just be anything. Because there's plenty of examples of bands that got a really heavy push that never connected. They're not always right, is what I'm getting.
Yeah, but that's the exception, not the rule, Bach.
No, I would say the exception is Nirvana and bands like.
There was a concerted push to push bands like Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. There was a concerted push through the industry. It was one of those things where it was blowing up on a small scale. They saw what it was, and they were like, well, if it's doing this well in Seattle, you know, wherever it was.
So it's a conspiracy.
That's
very 2020 of you.
Well, don't make me. I'm not going to put fucking tinfoil on my head.
You just put a collusion claim against all the record companies, too.
No, but like, what the big fucking? I hate to admit this, but and like you and people like you and me and Aaron Camaro and Devin don't follow what the powers that they say you should listen to,
right?
But the majority of people out there do. I mean, it's fact. Why else would a song called Wet Ass Pussy be a big hit right now? Come on.
Is that WAP?
Yes.
Okay, Cardi B. One of my favorites. Yeah.
Yeah, how would you know?
Give me a break. Well, she's got so much talent, man.
She's got a great ass. I'll give her that. But
she's making strippers everywhere feel like they can be more, they can contribute more.
Yeah. Yeah, you can change things with your ass. But no, I mean, it was true. I mean, like, you know, listen to Janie Lane's old story. You know, he goes into the Capitol or whatever office one week and it's Warrant Cherry Pie. Goes in the next week, Alice in Chains Dirt. That shit is real.
That doesn't piss you off, though. Like, it literally, it wasn't one week. A week ago, you were our darling. No, you know what, man? You were writing shit like Cherry Pie, and that's kind of part of the issue. I don't know why I'm debating. This is your time.
But you honestly don't think that record companies, they will use up what you have, they'll make a hit off of you, and then they will toss you to the side like garbage? You don't think that really happens?
Oh, it definitely happens. But I also think that they don't get rid of cash cows, because a lot of really big money making.
Oh, sure they do. They make more money.
Well, actually, they do it all the time. What am I talking about? No.
Dude, they make more money off one or two hit wonders than they ever do fostering a long-term career, because you got to pay that much more out if it's a long-term career.
No, you're 100% right there. I misspoke. I can come up with countless examples. I remember like of where it, like, this new boss comes in and, like, well, even though we've already given you $500,000 to record the record and you've been promised another $500,000 in promotion, we are going to sandbag this so it doesn't succeed, so then we can cut you and won't have to bring you back in for the next project. So, yeah,
it's
of
still,
course.
Still cheaper than fostering a career where you have to pay out that much more.
Oh, sure.
Over a decade.
No, I was agreeing with you on that. I think that was the point. Well, I don't even know what to make of the shit now where someone like Billie Eilish, you know, sells out 8,000 seaters before a record is even released. The industry has just turned into this where it's almost like ticketing and merchandise is more about it, you know, and that's why, you know, you have no idea who this person is, and all of a sudden they're the hugest thing.
Yeah, well, that's what it's about. It's about maximizing profit on a short-term amount of time to where they can't get too big for their britches, and then you can toss them out like yesterday's garbage and then move on to the next flavor of the week. I mean, and, like, you know, some people...
Then how do you explain Beyonce? People still care about that talentless hack.
Well, because she's married to a guy who's high up in the satanic leftist cabal.
Oh, we're in the Illuminati.
Right.
More of the conspiracy.
So the Illuminati is backing her and him, so therefore they can keep going.
A lot of triangles in her videos. A lot
of triangles. It's kind of sad. It's sad that I have to say I'm kidding, but I'm kidding.
Yeah, but we're on Skype right now, people. He shook his head like no while he said he was kidding. So
yeah.
The conspiracy.
I'm sitting in lotus position with a triangle over my head.
Well, I jumped on you a little bit there. Like I said, I'm not sure why. This is your time. Did you get your full point made on whether or not grunge killed hair metal?
It's a combination of things, dude. It's like you can't say it's one thing, but the majority of it is the industry decided to push something else. You know, it was like, you know, this is happening in Seattle, so let's go with it. And then at the same time, though, they had wrung out everything dry with the hair metal thing that you could. You got Pretty Boy Floyd and bands like that. King of the Hill, good God. Even worse than Pretty Boy Floyd. Great cartoon, but terrible band. But, it got to that point where they had kind of wrung the dish rag dry. And you know, it became a whole cookie-cutter formula. It was like, okay, you've got to release the power ballad, and then that's going to be the hit. Where it got to the point where even good power ballads were getting ignored because it was just such a fucking tried out method.
You're a big power ballad guy. Do you have? I'm putting you in the spot here, so if you don't have it, that's okay. Do you have an example of a song that you thought was a great power ballad that got ignored during this time?
Oh sure, "Bad for Each Other" by Shark Island.
Okay, one I've heard. The one I can remember.
You haven't heard that one?
I've definitely heard that whole records, but give me.
Tora Tora put out Wild America in 92. They had a song
God,
called
Time. How
was
that late, huh?
Yeah, Time Goes By. It was like a Tesla ballad.
Okay.
That was a good one.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back to Facelift. We have side two coming up here. What a great way to open up the second side of the cassette. It ain't like that.
I ripped this one off also from my band. Because I love the whole downstroke of, you know, sweeping against the strings.
Right behind the pick hand.
Yeah. It's just such a – it's almost like a – it's like if there was sleaze grunge, this is what that song would be. I love the song.
Another fun one to play, like you were talking about. But
super easy.
No, the way you described it. Now, I was taught to pick the down pick on that behind the fretted chord. If I'm showing it like that, That would kind of gives it that kind of, I don't know, chambery melodic effect.
Well, where you like you hold the finger barely above the strings and get the harmonic sound out.
You fret the first chord and then hit it right behind the hand. So
yeah, okay. I used to do that, and we ripped this one off. It's a good song, although I will say this one it doesn't have a lot of changes in it. So after the first couple of minutes, it kind of wears itself out for me.
You can learn it real quick.
Yeah, I would give it a 4 out of 5.
I gave it 4 out of 5 Mike Stars too. This was, like I said, it was another fun one to play at the time. And this is back when cover bands would play current tunes, not just old ones. That's another thing that's kind of been lost. Really a cool guitar solo in this one too. One of my favorite solos of Jerry's on this record. But
it's good, and I have the whole "In my life, not forgotten, feel as though a tooth is rotten."
Yeah,
yeah, great line.
Yeah, some really good lyrics here. This is one that was a grower on me, though. Like, it was not one that connected with me early on, and then when it did, it was like, "Fuck, that's great." And then when
it's
they did it. I think they play this in that movie Singles.
Yeah, they did. It's a great side opener for sure.
Yeah. What about Sunshine?
This is one of the two songs that I do not like on this record.
Wow.
It just doesn't do anything for me. And I know, I believe it's about Jerry's mom who had passed away recently, in which that kind of adds a little bit of dimension to it. But I don't know. This song just never really connected with me. This is one of the two songs that I usually skip on this record. I'd have to give this like maybe a 2.
Bummer.
I love that opening riff. I don't even know what the hell's going on there. It sounds like Sunshine when he plays
good
it.
Good point.
It's a tad Southern rock sounding.
Excuse me?
But I mean, I guess the riff I like, maybe I'll bump it to a 3, but
Sunshine.
It just doesn't really go anywhere, though. It just kind of meanders.
You're not going anywhere.
Nice one.
That's true.
I gave this one 4. So we're definitely not on the same path here. 4 Mike Stars for me on this one. Up next, we got Put You Down.
I can't see what the cost will be. No, I don't need you. I just can't put you down. I can't see what it all means to me. Honey, I don't need you. I just can't put you down.
So did you say that Layne Staley got turned on to heroin after this album was made?
Yeah. According to that book, it was during the Van Halen tour. And he went into rehab the first time after Sap.
Because the lyrics on this song sound totally like he's singing about heroin.
Huh.
I don't need you. I just can't put you down. It sounds just like he's singing about heroin.
I thought it was about a woman, but...
And then, like, speaking of Southern rock, because Jerry Cantrell grew up on old school country and, you know, Southern rock stuff like Skynyrd and 38 Special. And this has a very Lynyrd Skynyrd guitar riff to it. And that's what I love about it. It's like, and you never think a band from Seattle would come up with a riff like this, but it sounds like something Skynyrd would have done. I love this song.
I'm going back to your thing about the lyric, because that's like, I can't see what it might cost to me. That could be a drug reference like that.
It's got to be
a drug
reference.
But it could also be taking your woman shopping.
Yeah, but
you hand her the credit card, and she comes out with 3 bags, and you're like, I don't know what it cost.
You've been hanging out with LC too much.
Or my wife. She likes to shop, and she works in a mall.
Yeah, but we haven't even gotten to the last song in this record, and you know what that's about.
Okay, well, we're coming up on it. I'm with you. I love this tune. It's got that great tune. I get the Southern rock thing, but there's something very not Southern about the way it sounds and the way they play it. Like, you know, I think like the way you describe it is almost more like if you were teaching it, these are the same notes and something like that. And it might have to do with the tuning or just the guitar tone or something like that. But it definitely sounds different.
It's tuned down. And like another thing I want to point out, like after the solo, it gets to a point where Jerry starts playing the same riff, but he modulates it up one step and then two steps.
Oh, nice. Now, that's a classic rock kind of thing to do. Alice Cooper did a lot of that.
And like that you would normally, from a grunge album, you wouldn't hear that type of thing. So it's like one of those things where like they took risk on this record that after 1990, those types of bands were not allowed to take those risks.
You know, one thing about this record that definitely does separate it from kind of that hair metal stuff is the beefiness to the guitar tone and allowing that to be thick, but more importantly, the bass actually having a presence. A lot of those, like during the 80s with the glam metal, that was, you know, not really a thing. It was a very compressed bass, didn't really come up front, and that became kind of a calling card for grunge.
Yeah,
and this album definitely has both those things. It's more like, you know how like guys like Michael Wagner, or who's the guy that did a lot of the Motley Crue records, Tom Werman, or even Max Norman, they kind of produced records for hair metal in a way. Like they knew what the sound was supposed to be. Where you're more bigger picture kind of guys that are looking at records that are from a broader audience would kind of produce things more like this was. And I think Dave Jordan kind of comes across that way. And the handful of, what was he? He did like a Red Hot Chili Peppers record or.
Yeah, and he did.
Anthrax, The Sound of White Noise is coming up, but.
He did Jane's Addiction.
That's the one I was trying to think of.
Nothing shocking.
Yeah, and I was kind of surprised because I always had a hard time listening to that record sonically. It's not very warm. You know what I mean? It's very abrasive. But that's kind of what Jane's Addiction sound is.
Right.
We're probably getting a little too nerdy on some of the stuff. But to me, the way this record was mixed and recorded, it kind of separates itself a little bit from that glam metal.
I mean, Dave Jordan kind of aped Bob Rock on this record, especially with the drum sound. It's got a huge drum sound to it, which you don't hear on a lot of grunge records.
One thing I wanted to bring up, though, was they had a roadie. Like, it was either the guitar tech or the drum tech. They had never worked with Alice in Chains before on their first big tour, the one with Extreme. They heard the record, and they're like, oh, these guys they're never going to be able to pull this off live. This record is overproduced. I never thought that about this record. I think this record sounds actually pretty stripped down.
Yeah,
that guy sounds like an idiot to me who doesn't know what an overproduced record. Because you mentioned Bob Rock. To me, I'm thinking like Motley Crue, where it's like, yeah, you can kind of hear 900 layers of guitars and this thick thing.
Sure.
While this has a nice thick guitar tone, you can clearly hear guitar, bass, drum, vocal. You know, things are doubled and there's the harmonies, but this is not an example of an overproduced album.
No, it's not overproduced, but like Sean Kenny is the unsung hero of the record.
Yeah.
Because he's beating the living shit out of his drum set on this record.
Tall for a drummer, too. Most drummers aren't that tall.
Seems like a douche to me. Like in interviews that I've seen, he seems like an asshole. But
I think he's just kind of, no, I think this part is typical. He's just dumb. That's as most drummers are. Like, and most drummers aren't aware that they're dumb.
It all goes back to Kiss, and like one of my least favorite clips of him is after they played the Detroit Tiger Stadium show. He's showing off his tour book that he got signed by the whole band. He's like, "Kiss tour book 1977,
yeah,
autographed
I saw that.
By the whole band." But you don't have it. I'm like, "Fuck you."
You just pissed off. He got some autographs you wanted.
I was like, "Quit being a." He comes off like a high school douchebag.
Well, did you get mad at Sebastian Bach and his Cribs when he's like? He was like, "Do you have this signed? I do." And his pinball glass is signed by Kiss.
I'm mad at him for a lot of reasons.
Oh, that's right. You guys are fighting.
Mostly, yeah, he fucking hates us.
You just recently talked about why, too. What episode was that?
Well, Michael Wagner came on the show, talked about the making of Slave to the Grind and the first record with Rachel. And he was really kind about it, but he was basically said took a lot of takes to get Sebastian's vocals down. Apparently one of my friends wanted to meet Sebastian in Kentucky and mentioned the episode, and so I was like, "Oh, I don't like those guys, fuck those guys, and tell Michael I'll never work with him again." It's like, well, whatever, dude. I love Sebastian as a performer and a singer, but he's an overgrown 12-year-old. We talking about Alice in Chains?
Yeah, let's get back to Alice in Chains. We left on off of on Put You Down, right?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know if we got our ratings out there. I had 4 Mike stars on that.
I give it 4.
Okay. Up next, track 10 is Confusion. Yeah.
Least favorite track on the record. Goes nowhere, kind of just meanders along the whole time, just does nothing for me. I'd give it a 2.
The chorus helps on Confusion, but it's not a strong song in my bank or in my book either. I gave it, I don't know. To me, this is a very front heavy record. When we get to the second half, it's got its moments, but the weak spot seems to stick out here, and this is one of them. So I think we're on the same page there. I gave it 3.5. Up next is track 11 with I Know Something About You. I hope you like this a little better.
Like this one a lot. Right. This one, I give this one a 4. It's an experimental track. It almost sounds like Alice in Chains doing a Chili Pepper song. It's got that little funky sound to it. I love Mike Starr's bass playing on it. It's it's a tad dated now because it sounds like something that would have come out in 1990 compared to what would come out now. But I like it. It's a good song. It's probably a filler track, but it's what I would call killer filler.
Okay. Maybe I like it a little better. You said you gave it a 4, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I gave it a 4, too. I agree with everything you just said, that little kind of Chili Peppers opening and the way it kind of even kind of funky groove to it all the way through. I know something about you. Yeah, it's killer. Killer filler, I guess. So, yeah, 4.
And I ripped off this bass line also.
Of course you did. apparently you were in an Alice in Chains tribute band.
Well, we might as well. Well, no. I mean, if you heard us, you'd be like, oh, it sounds like they're trying, but not good. We were not good, trust me.
Well, it's difficult. Lane Staley is a tough guy to fucking fill any kind of void for. But
yeah, we could not fill that void, trust me.
Yeah, not too many people can. But Sebastian Bach could. I think he tried on Cameo. The album ends with Real Thing.
I grew up, went in rehab. You know the doctors never did me no good. They said, son, you're gonna be a new man. I said, thank you very much. You can't afford the divorce. Yeah. Under the hill, with just a few notches on my belt. Just one more, cause I'm going down the steps on a white line. Going down the steps on a white line. Going down the steps on a white line. Straight to nowhere.
I'm gonna take the lead on this one because it sounds like you have something to say about it. This song is forgettable. I don't really need it.
What?
Yeah, nothing for me. Other than the end when he says sexual chocolate, it used to make me chuckle, but then I, you know, became an adult.
You don't like this song at all?
Not really, no. I mean, I like it more than I Can't Remember or Love, Hate, Love, but it only got 3.5 for me.
Wow. I love this song. That's funny that you thought the redeeming part was the sexual chocolate line. That's like the part that I don't like.
That wasn't a compliment on the song when I said that.
Oh, I get it. It's like, it definitely dates it to that time. Mm. No, I love it. I mean, it's one of those things where I was, 13, 14 when this came out. So it was like, you know, the whole drug culture thing and everything, like it seemed kind of glamorous at the time before you get into it. So it was like one of those things where it's like, wow, that sounds really cool. Going down the steps on a white line straight to nowhere. That's like some really cool druggy shit, you know?
Right.
But it's catchy though. I love it. And the whole, you know, the doctors never did me no good. They said, son, you're going to be a new man. Thank you very much. And can I borrow $50? I mean, that's a funny line.
Right.
You know, I love the whole fuck you, I'm going to snort blow whether you like it or not line, even though, you know, we see how that ended. But at the time, it seemed cool when you're a teenager.
You don't think that, because we talked about whether or not he was introduced to heroin or drug stuff, this could almost be a sarcastic, almost like life's been good to me kind of lyric, you know, from Joe Walsh, where it's like almost like joking about, oh, I'm a rock star, I got to fucking snort coke, and everybody wants to borrow money from me, all that kind of stuff. It could have been a little more like Lane's attempt at being a little bit satirical.
I don't think it was, though. Well,
that's clear.
Like, I think he was.
I'm thinking maybe it was. I don't know.
He was. I mean, he was at least nose deep into blow at the time.
Fair enough. Well, he was curious.
Yeah, but I just as a teenager listening to it, it was like, yeah, fuck the man. You know, it was like, you know, do drugs, get fucked up, throw your life away, treat yourself. You know, that whole thing.
Well, this is a record that will always mean a lot to me. It definitely, you know, this is when I'm, you know, out on my own for the first time in my life. I'm broke. I'm in college. I'm doing all that kind of just bullshit, that stereotypical kind of crap. I'm also deciding I want to be a musician and not sure how I should transition. Like, how am I going to drop out of college, make money, move somewhere where I can play music, and so all that stuff. And this Alice in Chains was very key in all that, from this to Dirt to Sap and the other one, Jar of Flies, all that stuff. That every time they released something new, I was blown away by it. There's other artists on this list at the time, but because this was a very coming of age time for me, I do think I benefited by being the right age for hair metal when it came up. I was 12 years old when Quiet Riot broke. And I was, I think, 19 going on 20 when kind of this stuff was happening. I look at it that way and think I was the perfect age for all this stuff. And this album will never go be too far for me. There's so many songs on this record that just still kick my ass. I'm emotionally a little, hopefully a little further down the line. But I leaned on bands like this to kind of, you know, just feel something that was kind of fucking with you when you're dealing with testosterone and emotions and all that kind of gross crap that happens to you when you're just starting to grow pubes on your balls and stuff. So love it. I would give the album a 5 out of 5. It's difficult because I do think Dirt is one of the best records ever. So this ranks a little below that for me, but it's really not far. It really is kind of 1A, 1B for me. It's too bad that that's really the only two solid original album outputs we got with Jerry and Lane, because as much as I love Sean, you're right, underrated there, and I do think Mike Starr added something. I think when Mike Inez came into the picture, it just kind of became a bass player, which is fine. I mean, honestly, Jerry can do enough on his own. He doesn't need that. But this record is just a masterpiece. What a great way to open it up. And nice that they didn't have a sophomore slump. So I kick it to you, my esteemed colleague.
And I'm not like a grunge aficionado. I mean, there was a lot of grunge stuff that I never even bothered listening to. So, I mean, I got in at the ground floor, and you know, 90 to 93 is around the main years that I listen to this stuff. So to me, it's the best grunge album ever made. I mean, I don't think there's anything that tops it. I would say that the Pearl Jam 10 record is close, but I would still listen to this before I would listen to that. But it means a lot to me. I mean, it was there during a difficult time in my life. I went through the angsty teen years when this album came out. And it helped me through a lot of stuff. It also helped me kind of fantasize about rock star life and the bad decisions that go along with it. But But it was a, you know, or like I said, I ripped off at least four different songs from this record from my own band. So that tells you how much influence it had on me. And it was like, and especially Jerry's guitar playing, it was like Ace Frehley with more soul, you know, it was, or, you know, like Tommy Iommi, Tony Iommi. Oh, I fucked that up. But it just, it's an amazing record. There's no other Alice in Chains record I would put above it. It would probably go Facelift, then Jar of Flies, and then Dirt for me. Yeah. I do like Dirt, but there are moments on Dirt that I just think drag it down, but into the dirt. So they say, but I bet this album is a lot more influential than people give it credit for. I think it's definitely the
underrated.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, I'm scared to say that in front of you, but it definitely falls in line with a lot of good stuff. But I think it's the bridge between hard rock and grunge rock, because you can hear a little bit of their past, because they were more of a glam band before Jerry joined the band. So you can hear parts of that, and you can hear their influences. Like I said, you can hear AC/DC in some of this stuff. You can hear Lynyrd Skynyrd in some of this stuff. So they do wear their influences on their sleeve. So overall, it's my favorite grunge record. So thanks for having me on to do this. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to go back. I think you made a good point. People don't really talk about this record in the sense that of the influence it had, but it was clearly there. Like, all the guitar players I knew were learning this kind of stuff at the same time. You know what I mean? As much as like as a comparison, I've mentioned several times that I think Ace Frehley, and even I'll throw Angus Young in that conversation. Either one of those guys influenced way more people to pick up a guitar and learn how to play than Eric Clapton ever did. Clapton kind of appeals more to people who wish they could be Eric Clapton and never actually play anything. And that's not a shot. That's not taking anything away from his talent, because there's a different level there. But this, to me, is like the 90s, you know, I mean, Jerry Cantrell, more than anybody in Pearl Jam, more than anybody in Soundgarden, maybe not Nirvana, because it was so easy to play. You might have been going, yeah, I'll fucking go play that. Jerry Cantrell kind of got people to pick up a guitar. He might have been one of the last guitar heroes, to be honest with you.
Well, I remember at that time, you know, 94 was when we recorded the demo. And I remember recording the demo and listening back to the mix, and my singer looking at me from my solo saying, you want to be Jerry Cantrell. So like, that tells you, like, he rubbed off on me.
Yeah.
So like, you know, he was a big influence on me. And I know he got a lot of it from Iommi and Frehley, but you know, he was very influential for sure.
He had his own style and sound though. I mean, as much as you can say that, he also was, you know, a Van Halen guy too, but
yeah.
Well, I had this coming in. So this came in at 15 in Rolling Stone. I move it all the way up to number 7 on the overall list. Did I hear you correctly? You put this sucker all the way at number 1?
Best one.
All right.
Overall.
Well, Chris, this has been a pleasure. Thank you for coming on. Check out the Decibel Geek podcast. Although, I swear to God, there's zero people listening to our show that doesn't already listen to yours. But I like to at least throw it out there for that meet. If anything, it's the other way around. Hey, Decibel Geek listeners, thanks for tuning in.
Well, we appreciate the plug, but no, I'm sure you guys are doing just fine on your own.
As always, the best to you and Aaron over there at Decibel Geek. Thanks again for coming on and being part of this. Is there anything else you want to say?
Whatever.
All right, fair enough. Never mind. We'll be right back.
cherry pick two songs. I mean, like I said, only two songs are kind of the
fair enough.
The slips on this record. Everything else I love.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
It looks like your luggage is over 50 pounds. Is there anything you can take out?
Oh, yeah. Let me just toss all these $20 bills.
Great. Let me grab you a trash can.
Stop. Instead of throwing money away, move some clothes into a carry-on. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.